and I ask you all to come and hear me, not because I feel I can enlighten you, or that you, in especial, need my teaching on this subject, but because you can strengthen me, because by surrounding me on that occasion I shall feel that I am in the hands of those who have witnessed my shortcomings, and yet feel that in my obedience to the precious masters whose I am, and whom I serve, I have been permitted to render that which of myself I could not do. We have all felt that the Spirit has been amongst us here. Oh, extend to me the girdle of your affection, kindness, and sympathy amongst the strangers where I am now to be launched, and I have no fear of failure. I will offer but one pledge more in conclusion, and it is this: so long as you feel that I can be a mouthpiece for the presentation of those thoughts which find an echo in your own hearts, so long as you are seeking light from the spirit world, and I am standing like a footprint on its boundary, and am permitted to catch the dear voice of the Spirit, feebly re-echoing it again to you, so long as I can do this during my stay in England, I am yours. Addresses by E.H.B. 16. Questions answered extempore by Miss Emma Harding at the Winter Soirees, Harley Street, London, January 15th, 1866. Question 1. Can you assist us to comprehend the statement of Swedenborg, that in the spiritual world are neither time nor space, with reference to the accounts which he gives of its scenery, history, institutions, and occupations? Answer these questions, as we view them, may be resolved into one, for we deem that the main point to be considered is the question concerning time and space. The occupations of the spirit world, as detailed by the Swedish seer, would necessarily involve the idea, both of time for their performance, and of space for what is represented to his vision, as the scenery of the spirit world. We must first recur to some of the positions assumed when last we met, and again attempt to define time and space as they are familiar to yourselves. Time on earth is nothing but a succession of periods, during which certain changes in matter are taking place. The chief divisions of time known to you upon this planet are necessarily regulated by its movements, with reference to other bodies in space. The chief of these movements are the revolution of the planet upon its axis, and its annual revolution round the sun. The first movement, namely, the revolution of the planet on its axis, necessarily involves the relations which the sun and the earth occupy towards each other. In a former address I presumed to offer my hypothesis concerning the origin of light, and claimed that it was the result of a galvanic action which takes place between the atmosphere of the sun and that of the earth, that the result of the attrition of the atoms, for material atoms they are which compose the atmospheres of these two bodies in space, produces a change which first elaborates heat, and next luminosity, or such a change in the atoms as causes them to give off the quality called light. I think the production of light is mainly due to the energetic action which goes on between the solar fluid and the emanations or vapors of the earth, and that their galvanic action upon each other is the cause both of heat and light. Nay, even more, I think it will be ultimately shown in chemistry, that it is this action which produces the abundance of nitrogen, of which so large a part exists in combination with oxygen in atmospheric air, hence that the presence of nitrogen and the quality, peculiar to atmosphere in a state of action addresses by E.H.B. 17, called light, are both due to galvanism affected between the sun and that part of the earth's surface exposed to the sun's immediate influence. Hence light is the state which exists in atmosphere when the sun's rays are acting upon a certain portion of the earth. Darkness or absence of light is the result when that action is no longer going on. Hence, the division of the periods when the sun and earth are related to each other into days and nights, marked by the alternations of light and darkness. Hence also, time is but a definition of the periods of change which the sun and the earth sustain towards each other, and such periods as defining more accurately those changes, are divided into hours, and these again into minutes and seconds. Again, the changes which take place between the sun and the earth, produced by the inclination of the earth's axis, and requiring to affect them longer periods than days and nights, are called seasons, whilst the annual revolution of the Earth around the Sun is termed a year. Now, we will show you how purely special, and peculiar only to the relations sustained between bodies in space like the Sun and the Earth, are those subdivisions of period called time. Take for example the subdivisions of time even upon your own planet, in the difference between the equatorial and the Arctic regions. In the latter you find that the day, instead of being something over 24 hours, is little less than 6 months, and the night rather over the same period. When discovery arrives at that point for which John Franklin and his Western martyrs have laid down their mortal lives in the bitterest form of death ever endured by man, when you arrive at that point to which the finger of inspiration is still directing man, the actual polar point of the Earth, not alone its magnetic pole, night and day will cease altogether. In the vast area of ether, where the free and unshadowed beams of the Sun, produced as I have claimed by its galvanic action with the Earth, shall pour forth without intervention or remission by any of the changes which operate only in sections alternately exposed to, and turned from the Sun, then and there even upon this Earth you will perceive that there is literally neither night nor day, and hence no time. Thus, except in certain portions even of this planet, time does not exist except as a mere technical arrangement by which you mark the various changes which material bodies are ever undergoing. You might as well attempt to claim that time exists because there must be certain periods for the growth and development of mineral forms, for the precipitation of the atoms of matter into metallic veins, or into the growth of trees, or the blossoming of flowers. Periods are required to effect all these changes. Periods are occupied in every change incident to the growth and decay of material forms, but as these periods vary with the peculiarities of every form and substance, so they cannot constitute arbitrary and fixed divisions of time in eternity. Were it possible, however, to classify periods, thus infinitely varied, into time upon this planet, such an arrangement could not subsist in any other body in space. For instance, the revolution of the satellite Mercury around the Sun would give it the equivalent to a year and 87 of our days, that of Venus 224 of Earth's days, and as every other known body in space exhibits varieties equally marked in proportion to distances, weight, velocity, and other incidental causes, the periods which mark time upon one planet would be totally inapplicable to all others. Hence, if time depends upon the movements of material bodies and is only regulated by these, and these are, as I have shown, infinitely various, it is evident that no arbitrary division of eternity into fixed periods called time exists. Precisely the same definitions apply to space, which is simply the ether in which material forms effect their changes, but which, though boundless, is so filled with life and being, ranging, addresses by EHB 18, from the infinitely little to the infinitely large, that it is impossible to conceive of any unoccupied portion of a boundlessness we call infinity. It is argued that no one atom of matter can fill the place occupied by another atom, hence that there must be space to bound matter. I answer that the ultimate molecule of matter called an atom has never yet been discovered, nor the last point of divisibility attained. Even in the most seemingly impenetrable crystal, there are spaces filled up with gas and sublimated fluids, and in the rarest gas a space is occupied by ether, and ether is filled with electricity or magnetism. So, as all the realm of nature known to man is charged with matter in varying degrees of rarity, we have no evidence whatever to show that such a condition as space exists at all. Assuming, however, that we might define space by the magnitude of bodies, and the room which they occupy, our definitions are as various as those which apply to time. For as all bodies vary in size, and in every substance various others combine, it would be impossible to define the exact amount of room occupied by anything. For instance, water may receive in addition other fluids, and even soluble solids, as sugar or salt, without in the least changing the bulk of the whole. Size is indefinite, and matter all-pervasive throughout infinity, hence there is no rule by which to define space, even in material forms. Thus the only true definitions which can be given of time and space are those of being periods and places which are occupied in eternity and infinity to effect changes in material forms. We now turn to a consideration of the division of places and periods in the spirit world, and we ask how they correspond. I believe that I shall be understood by those who have realized the moral transmutation of spirits in the phenomena of death, the power which it exercises as a dominant and supreme principle in being, which the laws of matter cannot touch. I shall be understood by believers in such opinions, when I say that spirit is unhindered by, and supreme over all the laws of time and space as applied to changes in matter. The laws of matter do not even analogically define those which bind spirit. Spirit is a separate existence, an entity of itself. It is at once the cause and the ultimate of being. No laws of matter, nor even of magnetism, apply to spirit. It may be that we shall never step behind the sublime mystery of the I am within us to comprehend ourselves, but we do know enough of the revelations that are now patent amongst us and which have been brought so tangibly to the spirit circle as an open volume for our investigation, to realize that the spirit is independent both of time and space. And this is shown first in the fact that there is a moral transmutation in death, by which the deeds done in the body, the motives engraved upon the soul, and the habitudes of thought, which have at last become the custom and finally the character of the soul, that all this determines the external surroundings of the inhabitants of spirit land. If there is light within, the soul is its own source of light, and from that, as a central sun, go forth the irradiations of luminosity, that reveal, as in physical sunshine, or the splendors of an incomparable day, the grand and most glorious arcana of the nature of spirit land. Spirit not alone gravitates to the place to which it belongs, but it carries with it the scenery and characteristics of the place itself. We might recur again and again to the deeply philosophic, yet ill-understood, assurance of the Master, that the kingdom of heaven is not to be found by observation, lo, here, lo, there, but that it is within us. Even so are all the states in which the soul dwells. They are in fact gradations and conditions of addresses by EHB-19, mentality, represented in corresponding conditions of the soul's external life, and ranging from the highest state of illumination, to the lowest of darkness. And thus that which we have loved on earth, that on which we have poured out our human magnetism, and chained our affections to, becomes actually represented in the scenery and surroundings of the spirit world. There in the illimitable realm where time ceases and space is not, the spirit is chained and fettered to the point of its own peculiar attraction, and its memories and its loves are all externalized in representative scenery. These do not occupy space according to the boundaries which define matter. Spirit and spirit land are so fine, and infinitely pervasive, that this very chamber is even now full of the scenery, surroundings, and inhabitants of spirit land. In the chemical decomposition of death, spirit quits the form it occupied, yet all the attributes of matter will be found in their integrity with the form which was the man, but which, destitute of spirit, is man no more. Weigh the lifeless corpse, and nothing seems to be wanting, nothing there is lost, nothing at least that lived in what you call time, or occupied what man terms space. By this alone we find that the true man, the invisible, the spirit that has fled, has neither weight nor density, impenetrability nor divisibility, nay, nor any of the attributes of matter, but is like thought, free to come and go, and realizes none of the boundaries of time, nor the obstacles of space. There are no periods of darkness or of light with a spirit, except those moral states which continue only in proportion to its own growth and development. So long as the spirit wills by its affection, or by the force of habits acquired on earth, to remain in a condition of moral darkness, the scenery and surroundings of the soul correspond thereunto. So long as the spirit is radiant with light within, yet full of aspiration for higher and better spheres, its periods of residence in each will only be determined by its fitness for progressive changes, so that time in the spheres is only known by transitions from one glory to another, and by the soul's changes through varied spheres and different scenes. You ask how such vague and unsatisfactory ideas, for such they seem in comparison with the laws of matter, and in consequence of your views of time and space, are reconcilable with many of the statements of the spirit circle that there are houses, scenes, landscapes, and even occupations in the spirit world analogous to yours? I answer, there are all these in the spheres of earthbound souls. The habits, thoughts and affections of the spirit, if they are still earth-centered, will reflect on all around the spirit its own peculiar aspirations, and urge the soul to run in the grooves of its earthly occupations, but only so long as that soul loves the things of earth and aspires to nothing higher. When the spirit yearns for higher spheres, its aspirations are its means of progress, and in these higher spheres, the earth scenes cease to be. Again, the arbitrary distinctions which govern matter do not apply to the spirit, for it penetrates all space and all obstacles which make up forms in space. There is nothing so fine or sublimated in matter as to afford an analogical description of spiritual substance. No material bodies, nor the laws that govern their movements, represent the nature and laws even of magnetism. How then by material analogies can you attempt to define the yet more sublimated mystery of thought? Are there hindrances or obstacles of matter to the flight of thought? Send it, if you will, speeding away to the farthest realms of being. Let it traverse the galaxy of stars, launch it into the infinite, and only suffer it to anchor round the heart of its infinite Father. There is no obstacle to hinder you. Even so of your spirit, for thought is but the external manifestation of the spirit, addresses by EHB 20, truly, then, there can be no time for that which defines its own periods of change, no space for that which is all unhindered by every obstacle which makes up that which you call space. It is most difficult for those who live in time and space, as defined by matter, to comprehend the boundlessness and infinitude of spiritual existence, and for the occupations of spirits, you know as much of these as the earth-bound spirits can reveal to you. More than this you could not comprehend. You cannot leap beyond your shadow, and were we to tell you of occupations, scenes, instruments, machines, ideas, and entities of which you have had no experience, we should place you in the position in which you would place the uninstructed savage, were you to tell him of the attributes or civilization. In the higher spheres of spirit land conditions exist of which you have had no experience. I can but bid you share the faith of the brave apostle, who realized that he should pass from glory to glory, who knew it not, but believed it because he felt the spiritual truth in his very soul, and already saw with the eye of faith, the brightness of the glory to which his mortal course was tending like a foregleam of the incomprehensible life of heaven, irradiating his earthly way. This is the only interpretation we can give you of the spheres, and though so many of its conditions are still beyond your comprehension, we may realize enough to know that the bright and better world is unhindered by the laws and obstacles of matter, and that spiritual existence is independent of the mere local and material subdivisions of eternity and infinity called on earth, and belonging to earth alone, time and space. Question to many of the phenomena and communications which we are accustomed to attribute to spirits of departed persons have been explained by some on the principles of mind reading, of mesmerism, of clairvoyance, etc. Will you give us your explanation of this, and to what extent, if any, such phenomena may be thus accounted for? Answer those who claim that all communications which impress their minds without a visible or material origin proceed from disembodied spirits alone, forget that themselves are spirits, and that whatever attributes the spirits possess, whatever powers they can exercise, are measurably possessed by themselves. They forget, moreover, that the ever-ascending spirit is constantly obeying an invisible magnetism, namely, the action of the grand magnet of creation which I call God. I believe in God, I believe that the great spirit is related to me as a father to a child. Though I see him not, I know that he is, and that he is a magnet ever calling us up to him. Even in the deepest darkness of crime and ignorance he speaks in the voice of conscience to his erring children, and therefore I feel, though I cannot always interpret in human speech, his constant attraction upward and onward. I know, moreover, that I hold a relation and am kindred to all things in nature, whether in matter or form. Below myself, I know that the earthly magnetism of the lower kingdoms are also attracting me downwards. Between the two magnetisms, the supreme good and the antagonistic, my spirit strives and fights life's battle, in conquest or defeat. In this strife, and the daily external cares which belong to a material existence, in the difficulty of looking through the windows of the soul upon the world without, my spirit often seems wiser than I knew of. It has in part the gift of clairvoyance, addresses by EHB 21, sometimes the power of soul reading, and it can often receive monitions and impressions, though it knows not from whence. It is partly prophetic, and constantly sympathetic with distant things and persons, and it is in these mystic attributes of our own spirits that we do not always know how to disentangle the identity of our own soul's aspirations, powers and possibilities from the action which suddenly breaks upon us in the revelation of modern spiritualism. The presence of a spirit world has become to the uninstructed a great solvent in which they suppose that all occult powers of the soul are resolved and overshadowed, and they determine that whatsoever they cannot comprehend, or seems occult and strange, must be the action of disembodied spirits. We are apartment, therefore, to attribute in some cases too much to a spiritual source, in others too little. The spirit world is as the soul of this world, and bears to it precisely the same relation, so there is a perpetual action and reaction going on between the two worlds which produce influences of whose source and action we are often unconscious. Suppose some man of crime is bent upon the commission of a deed of murder and waits for the cover of darkness to commit his act of blood. Ere the shadow of the night is fully fallen, he lies down beneath some sheltering hedge to wait until the pall of darkness is thrown around his guilty way. As thus concealed, he crouches in obscurity, the sound of a young child's voice is heard singing a Sabbath hymn. Perhaps it is the strain of an old familiar prayer, which many years ago he learned at his mother's knee, ere guilt fell across his path life a gulf between the innocence of youth and the age of crime. Behold that gulf at this moment as he listens bridged over by that young child's voice. The memories evoked by those tones and words convert the man grown hoar with crime into a little child again. The past returns, and with a retrospect fraught with every deed he has done, and the many fearful steps he has trod, are all presented in panoramic view before him. With the fearful contrast of the happy past, and the miserable present, comes the deep resolve to arise and go to his father. The prodigal retraces then his steps and quits that spot a pilgrim on the road to heaven. Earth never knows the cause of change, but angels do, and know that the child was the murderer's ministering angel, he who made the hymn, the very hand that set it in published form afloat, the mother who taught the little one to chant it. All these, and every circumstance of time that brought the child within the reach of the ear of guilt were footprints of ministering goodness. And yet these agencies of redemption were all unknown to the man of crime, and to human reason unpremeditated, and yet it is ever so, and as we pass along the city street, in all our walks of every day and night, an angel's wing sweeps by us, we hear it rustle in the air, we scent the perfume of its fragrant presence as of flowers from paradise, perhaps we hear the music of its tread, we know not what it is that has filled us with good thoughts, we only realize that some inward monition has spoken and that we are better for its presence. Even so is the spirit world related to the natural. It is a world of unceasing influence, of unseen ministering spirits. We cannot define how far the soul's own supernal powers exceed the laws of matter, nor yet tell you wherein, by phenomenal acts alone, the spirit world is exercising influence upon you. Neither can I refer you to the scriptural test rendered by the apostle charging you to try the spirits only through the accepted belief of the writer, a belief that involves no question of good or evil, and simply applies to the mind's acceptance of a sectarian dogma. But we would charge you to try the spirits by the teachings they enunciate, and see if they agree with your highest sense of right, and echo the still small voice of God in your heart, speaking through the tones of conscience. Try the spirits through such teachings as Christ's, addresses by EHB 22, and if they be of God they will acknowledge that God speaks to man through every good and beautiful and holy word and thing that exists or has a being. Try them by reason, intelligence, and by the test facts of identity, try them by all those means which dictate to judgment in the daily affairs and common routine of life. You have your chemical tests, you have your standards of truth in morals, arts, and sciences. Even in astronomy itself, acting in apparently the largest, grandest, and the most unattainable sphere in which the human intellect can range, you can find tests of truth so accurate the man has gauged the heavens and measured the depths of infinity, and even be gazing on the blank expanse of millions of miles from the last sphere of his observation, he can determine the existence of undiscovered planets. If in this infinite largeness science has grappled with the mightiest problems of matter, cannot you apply reason, judgment, and the ordinary tests of truth, as known to men, to the simple and daily routine of intelligent communion between yourselves and the Spirit? You desire to know if father, brother, sister, or mother speaks with you. Seek for their identity through proofs known to such spirits as those you ask for, weigh carefully corroborative testimony, bring to bear the judgment and reason that you suffer to guide and direct you in other events of life. If God grants you the glorious privilege of communion with a higher world than yours, it is not to make you subjects to that higher world, but to raise you to it by the exercise of your own highest faculties. Know ye not that ye shall judge the angels? Therefore, I repeat, your question admits of no distinct definition, but I throw it back upon your reason to answer for yourselves, and if in the search for truth the ordinary modes of practice must be pursued, and you should stumble and fall, and often mistake your aim, grope in the dark, and sometimes fail in ascending to the topmost round of the ladder, where you can behold as in a vista all problems laid out that you seek to comprehend, if in this effort you fail to succeed at last, what then? Why, you have tested your strength, you have tried the muscles, us, and sinews of your soul and intellect, and in the strife gained more than you even sought. The grandest lessons that man has ever learned have ever been gained by his failures. And we must not hope to accept this mode of teaching from the communion called spiritualism, whose highest truths can only be discovered through patient effort, candid investigation, many failures, but ultimate success. Question 3. What are the ideas revealed to you regarding the law of temptation? Answer. I have already said that in our alliance to the world beneath ourselves, in our relations to the animal kingdom, in our gravitation to the earth on which we tread, in the fact that within us are to be found all the constituent elements of matter, and with them their forces and proclivities, so in all these, there is a perpetual tendency to outwork a set of lower faculties which of necessity grow out of our relationship with a lower kingdom than man's. It is not absolutely necessary, then, that a personal tempter should be present with us to realize the fact that we feel and often act out the irresistible tendencies of sin. Besides these movings to evil, originating in our connection with matter, consider the action of a personal and individualized tempter, addresses by EHB 23, and analyze how much of influence such a one can exert, in human or spiritual intercourse. Suppose that a murderer would tempt his fellow men to commit a deed of death. He arrays all the motives that would induce men to commit such an act. Acquisitiveness, hate, vengeance, a desire to rid the earth of the presence of some obnoxious person, any and every reason that could induce the committal of the deed are urged upon perhaps two differing human natures. On one they have no effect, on the other they are said to produce, by the strength of the temptation, a result in the deed of crime. This is the world's view of the action of temptation. But I affirm that the deed and its proclivities thereto were in the heart, or ever the tempter could have power over it. It is an impossibility that the weaker can control the stronger. We acknowledge this in physics, and yet in metaphysics by the world's verdict on temptation we deny it. But I believe that only if you are weaker, then the suggesting demon will make you yield. If stronger, his temptation has now power over you, but in your strength you may affect your tempter. For as you essay to resist him, you to array a set of motives which may influence him, and therefore while resistance to temptation strengthens yourself, the action is beneficent, and often proves a source of strength to others. In this sense, then, it seems that the philosophy of temptation is a part of a divine scheme, first for outworking by mental, moral and intellectual effort the soul's great latent powers of good and judgment. Next, as a means of freeing our spirits by a struggle from the material mold and its attractions in which we are born. Above all, it is a battle fought not only with ourselves but also with those undeveloped minds which seek to become our tempters. Temptation, too, to sin is a prompting to that spirit of investigation which teaches us to search into the sources of crime, not only in the world but in ourselves. Should we desire to bring to a yet more critical issue the subject of temptation, we must ask, who does the deed of sin? Whose hand is it that strikes the blow? Whose lip receives the intoxicating draught? Whose hand that shakes the dice? Whose tongue proclaims the angry word? Is it the tempters or the actors of the crime themselves?